The 13th Candle by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 6. At the edge of the Valley of Lhasa, where the beaten track dips deeply downwards on the way to the sweltering lowlands and eventually to China, the Lama and the small acolyte rested upon the hard-packed earth. A few yards away, the hobbled horses wandered in search of sparse grass. High overhead, a large bird wheeled in lazy circles. The small boy watched half-interestedly. His real interest was in the aches and pains which he endured whenever he sat upon a horse. Now he was reclining face down, turning his head sideways from time to time to watch the soaring bird. Soon he drowsed and then slept. People were resting in other parts of the world, too. In a radio factory in the western part of the world, workers were having one of their innumerable breaks from the monotony of factory existence. Rusty Nails, the shop carpenter, suddenly hooted with laughter and flung a blue-covered paperback contemptuously to the floor. "That guy must be nuts," he shouted. "God, what a lot of rubbish people get away with in books." "What's with you, man?" mildly inquired the dark little Jew, Isidore Shute, as he stooped and picked up the offending book. Rusty Nails spat his contempt and wiped his mouth on the back of his hand. "Ah," he exclaimed, "the whole thing is just plain silly." Ivan Austin, the truck driver, grabbed the book from Isidore Shute and looked at him. "Feeding the Flame by Love Sang Rampa. Oh, him," he exclaimed in disgust. "Don't believe him, do you?" he inquired to no one in particular, continuing, "The fellow is a nut. That's what he is, a nut." Shirley May, the telephone girl, bristled with anger. "That's what you think," she said angrily. "You haven't the brains to know any better, Big Mouth." She shrugged her shoulders and glared angrily at poor Ivan Austin. "Ah, gee, you dumb broad," he shouted in exasperation. "Even you don't believe that, he fumbled for a word, "that crap. Do you? Why, the fellow is a—" The door opened, and one of the typists, Candy Hater, wiggled in. "You folks sure are shouting," she remarked, "but I know the truth of these books. That author was accused, tried, and condemned by the putrid press without having been given any chance to defend himself. That's the press for you, and saps like you," she glared at poor Rusty Nails and Ivan Austin, "are so stupid that you believe the newspaper's hook, line, and sinker. Pah!" "Yeah, ma'am, that's okay," interjected Bill Collector from the accounts department. "But just you listen to what this crazy guy writes." He fumbled at the book, polished his glasses, and glanced round at his audience before reading. "Feeding the Flame by Love Sang Rampa, page 23, last paragraph. It is absolutely possible to make a device which will enable one to telephone the astral world. It has actually been done." His voice trailed off, and there was a moment's silence, broken by Ivan Austin, saying, "See what I mean? It's crazy! The guy must have been high on drugs when he wrote that." Ernest Truman, chief of the research department, pursed his lips. Then he rose to his feet and went into his office, returning seconds later with the magazine opened at a certain page. "Now I will enter the discussion," he said. "Listen to me while I read extracts from a most influential British magazine." He stopped and scanned the page before him. The door opened again, and the works manager, R.U. Crisp, walked in. "What gives?" he asked brusquely. "You people think I'm paying for a mother's meeting? Get moving, get cracking, get back to work. Quick, vamoose, fast." "Mr. Crisp, sir," said Ernest Truman. "A minute, sir. In the interest of the advancement of technical knowledge with which we may later be involved, I would like to read these people and you a few paragraphs." R.U. Crisp pondered a second and then came to a crisp decision. "Okay," he said. "I know how earnest is your desire to educate us all, so call in my secretary, Alice May Kling, and she will take a verbatim report on it." Secretary Kling hurried in together with the canteen girl, Sherry Wines. There was rapt attention as Ernest Truman began to speak. After all, they were getting paid to listen to this, and it was much easier than assembling radios. "There has been denigration and doubt against the author, Rampa, for daring to suggest what is in fact a scientific possibility," pontificated Ernest Truman. "He has been the subject of much scoffing for his suggestions and definite statements. Now," he rustled the magazine, "now the preeminent British radio magazine, The Wireless World, dated June 1971, has an article on page 312 of that issue under the title of Electronic Communications with the Dead. I will read you extracts, but you may refer to the publication itself if you wish to read the extensive article concerned." He stopped, peered over his glasses, wiped his nose, and cleared his throat, and then he read on. "Free Grid's comments on metamorphosed waves," see page 212 of the April issue, "reminded me of a curious incident which happened to me some years ago and for which I have never been able to find a rational explanation. When I was about 14 years old, I discovered, lying in a loft, an ancient radio of the type which I believe was known in the 1920s as a DET21.F. I refurbished this museum piece, and being curious as to its DX capabilities," DX means long distance, "it became my practice during school holidays to set the alarm for 2 a.m. and to search, using headphones, for American stations. But now we come to the curious bit. On two or three occasions over several weeks, at times when I had removed the aerial plug-in coil to change wavelength, which meant that the aerial was virtually open-circuited, a raucous voice burst the silence with a few words. It was clearly speech, but so distorted as to be unidentifiable as to content. Only a few words occurred at a time, although I remember waiting for about an hour, hoping to hear more, but without success. Most of the European stations had long since closed down. and I was remote from any high-power commercial transmitters. Neither were any amateurs operating in the area. I'd all but forgotten about it until reminded by Free Grid's hypothesis. Then, in the curious way things happen, I came across a newly published book called Breakthrough, which I strongly commend to your attention. The author claims that an ordinary common or garden tape recorder, if switched on and left to its own devices, can, on playback, be found to reproduce voices originating from the dead. Now, there are a few words which are more emotive than spiritualism, with vehement pro and anti camps arising at the mere mention of it. So if you are anti and find yourself muttering more mumbo-jumbo about vibrations and ectoplasm, just hold your horses and bear with me for a moment. Personally, at the moment, I stand uncommitted. I only know what I have read. The author, Dr. Rawdive, is not an electronics man, but he has apparently recorded some 72,000 of these voices, and a selection of these has been put onto a gramophone record which is on general sale. What is even more important from our standpoint is that he has called in a host of independent opinions, including those from highly qualified physicists and electronic engineers, all of whom verify the claim that voices do appear on the tape, although not all are convinced that they originate from the dead. No one can offer any theory which reconciles known natural laws with the phenomena. The electronics engineers have experienced this mysterious voice production using their own equipment and have waited in with various circuits of their own devising, and this book gives diagrams, which offer improvements on the original Rawdive apparatus. Incidentally, it is suggested that videotape might provide a medium for further developmental work. As for the end products, these are described as voices which identify themselves, call our names, tell us things that make sense, or sometimes puzzle us. These voices do not originate acoustically, and the names they give belong to people we know to have left this earth. The voices are on a tape which can be listened to and heard by everybody. The physicists cannot explain the phenomena, and the psychologists cannot offer an explanation either. Scientific tests have shown, in a Faraday cage, for example, that these voices originate outside the experimenter and are not subject to autosuggestion or telepathy. Philologists have examined the phenomena and testified that, although audible and understandable, the voices are not formed by acoustic means. They are twice the speed of human speech and of a peculiar rhythm which is identical in the 72,000 examples so far examined. This was written in italics. It also seems that the sentences are telegraphies in character, and when the experimenter is multilingual, the language may be polyglot. One word perhaps in Swedish, the next in German, the next in English, and so on. Like the messages purporting to emanate from conventional psychic sources, the accent seems to be on identification of friends and relatives who have passed over. The sincerity of the book seems beyond question, and the near 100 pages of appendices give much technical detail of the apparatus used, as well as hypotheses regarding the cause of the phenomenon. The theories involving relativity and antimatter are among those present. One thing is sure, and that is that the problem of the origin of these voices cries out for investigation. I know, as well as you, that the whole thing sounds impossible. How can words be derived from a silent microphone? But don't forget that in 1901 it was theoretically impossible for radio waves to cross the Atlantic because no one knew of the existence of the ionosphere. By the same token, there are no doubt a lot of things about electronics of which so far we know nothing. Ernest Truman came to the end of his reading. Slowly he closed the magazine, removed his spectacles, and wiped his brow with a large white handkerchief. That done, and the spectacles again on his nose, he looked round to see what effect his reading had had. For moments there were stunned faces around him. Ivan Austin stood with his mouth open. Alice May Kling was clinging to the arm of her girlfriend. Rusty Nails released a deep breath and a profound expression, "Gee, what do you know?" Eva Brick, the girl who packed up the glass tubes, smiled knowingly as she turned to her friend, Ivy Cord, and said, "Well, well, so Lovesang Rampa has been proved right again. Am I ever glad?" "Are you, Crisp?" had the last word, though. "Back to work, folks. You've had your fun. Back to work. This is a costing." So, in ones and twos, the staff went back to work as slowly as they could, while discussing the matter as fast as they could. Rest was ended, too, on the edge of the valley of Lhasa, where the trail swept down to the lowlands, and where Lama and Acolyte were getting to their feet preparatory to continuing their journey on the reluctant ponies. Once again, the ponies shied away from the boy and indeed made fun of him, keeping just, and only just, beyond his reach, evading even his most energetic darts in an attempt to grab them. At last the llama again stepped forward, and the ponies came towards him as docile as could be. Once again the llama and the acolyte mounted, and, clutching their bundles, rode off down the trail. The llama rode ahead. Perhaps 50 yards behind him came the acolyte, being favored by fortune in that his pony wanted to follow his friend, because the acolyte had little control over his steed. But the journey continued between towering rocks, beneath the lips of immense precipices. Gradually they approached the Happy River. Here it was called the River Yalanbujang, but upon leaving Tibet and making a sharp hairpin bend through the mountains, it would become the mighty Brahmaputra, which, growing in volume and strength, would sweep down to the Bay of Bengal and become one of the most important rivers in India. Now it was a happy river, having some three sources in Tibet, all coming together in Lhasa, in the valley of Lhasa, and being fed by many, many tributaries in the valley of Lhasa. Innumerable springs welled up at the foot of Iron Mountain and at the foot of the Potala, and formed the Serpent Temple Lake and the Willow Pond, and the marshes, and then slowly drained out into the Happy River. Now, on the downward slopes beyond the valley of Lhasa, the river was becoming broader and stronger. The Lama and the acolyte continued their journey, 3 days, perhaps 4 days. One loses count of days in a land where time matters not, where there are no clocks, no watches, nothing but the passing of the sun and the phases of the moon to mark the days and the months. They passed down from the higher mountainous plateaus to the lowlands, where the rhododendron trees grew to immense size, and the blooms were a mass of flaming color, each bloom the size of a good cabbage, and the trees of the rhododendron plant itself reaching perhaps 25 to 30 feet in height. Here, too, there were many, many different plants and trees. The air was steaming, foggy, and hot, because here the air was trapped in a rocky defile, in a deep rift. On one side was the rock face, and on the other, on the right-hand side, was the rushing river, roaring and screaming as it screeched over gorges and fell 100 feet at a time over rock lips to go plopping into deep pools below. Time and again, the Lama and the acolyte had to cross and recross and cross again the river on precariously placed bridges made of poles suspended on long strips of creeper plant, strips of creeper as pliant as rope and with the strength of the parent wood. Each time the two ponies had to be blindfolded and led carefully across the bridge, for no pony or horse would cross such a dangerous structure as these temporary bridges. The young acolyte waddled across one bridge, rubbing his rearmost portion ruefully. "Oh, honorable Lama," he exclaimed, "having now ridden these days, I quite understand why the traders who go to India and return have such a peculiar walk." At last, 3 or 4 days later, with their barley exhausted and suffering the pangs of hunger, they came in sight of a little lamasery nestling down deep in a valley. At the back, a waterfall came tumbling over a cliff edge and passed to the side of the little lamasery, rushing down on the endless journey to the Bay of Bengal. In front of the lamasery, some 50 or 60 monks were gathering, looking upwards, shading their eyes against the sun. At last, as the tall Lama rode into their range of vision, they broke into smiles of welcome, and the abbot of the lamasery moved forward with cries of pleasure. Monks seized the ponies and helped Lama and acolyte dismount. The young acolyte was preening himself here, for was he not one of the acolytes from the Potala in holy Lhasa? Was he not one of the elite of the elite? Was he not accompanying the great venerable Lama to give instructions to this lamasery? Then of course he was worthy of the greatest respect. He was worthy of the respect due to a junior Lama, at least. So he preened himself and strutted round, and then suddenly he remembered he was hungry. The abbot was talking animatedly to the lama, from the highest center of lamastic learning. Then, all of a sudden, the party moved on, an impulse, into the lamasery, where there was hot tea and sampa. The young acolyte took a hearty swig of tea and thought the world had come to an end. He coughed and sputtered and blew tea all over the place. "Oh, holy lama!" he exclaimed in terror. "Help me, quick!" The lama moved to him swiftly and said, "Do not fear. Nothing has happened to you. Remember, we are much lower here, and so hot tea is hotter. As I've been trying to tell you, the boiling point of water in Lhasa is quite cool compared to what it is here. Here you'll have to wait a little, not drink so quickly. Now, drink again, for the temperature will be less by now." So, saying and smiling, he went back to his discussion with the abbot and some of the local lamas. The acolyte, feeling rather foolish, very gingerly picked up his drinking bowl and this time cautiously sipped the tea. Yes, it certainly was hot, hotter than anything that he had ever tasted before, but it was very pleasant. And then he turned his attention to the sampa, which also was hot, the first hot sampa he had tasted in his life. But already the trumpets were blaring. Already there was the sound of the conches. Clouds of incense came wafting out of the temple door, and from nearby came the deep sound of lamastic voices as monks and lamas started their evening service, to which the high lama and the acolyte were now about to go. That night there was much talk of the doings in Lhasa, talk brought from India by the traders and relayed to the monks, who told the lamas, and then there was the counterpoint of conversation with the lamas and the acolytes at the small lamasery. There were tales of the tea planters at Assam, tales of traders from Bhutan, and of course the inevitable stories about the Chinese, about their villainy, about their treachery, about how, in the years to come, they would invade all of this land. The talk went on endlessly. The sun set early here, and the deep gloom pervaded this dark cleft of the valley. Here in the night there was much more noise. There were many more birds, many more animals, than in the vicinity of Lhasa. This was the lowland, and the young acolyte found great difficulty in breathing. He found the air too moist, too thick. He found that he was drowning in air, and restlessly he prowled about, finding it quite impossible to sleep in the confines of a communal monk's dormitory. Out in the open, there was the pleasant scent of flowers wafted on the cool night breeze. Animals called, and night birds went flapping off as darker shadows against a dark sky. At his left, the happy river plunged over a rock edge and went rushing down in a splatter of white froth and foam, dislodging rocks and pebbles in its hurry to get down to the sea. The young boy sat on a rock by the side of the waterfall and thought of all the things that had happened to him. He thought of his life at Shakpuri, he thought of his life in the Potala, and now, on the morrow, he thought he was going to have to attend lectures by his beloved lama on breathing. Suddenly, the night became darker still. The wind turned chill and, being moist, seemed to strike through to the bone. Shivering, the young boy rose to his feet and hastened into the lamasery to sleep. The light of the new day was much slower in reaching this little lamasery hidden in the sheltered valley, encompassed on every side by towering rocks heavily clothed with subtropical vegetation. For in this valley, with its closed-in atmosphere, the temperatures rose rapidly. The rays of light from the sun were cut off until almost mid-morning, and here there was a gloominess, a steamy gloominess. High overhead, the sky was of pellucid luminescence, the light of the newborn day. No longer did the stars shine brightly, no longer were there rays of the setting moon. All was bright, and yet, in this valley, the young acolyte found it oppressive, stifling. He felt drowning in air, as it were. He rose and made his way from the dormitory out into the open. Out into what to him was the gray light of day. Grayness filtered down through mist or fog, grayness accentuated by the leaping spray which, because of the dullness, showed no scintillating rainbows. The young acolyte felt he was alone in a sleeping world. He thought how lazy they were down in this quiet backwater of religion. So he wandered to sit by the side of the waterfall. There he reflected upon some of the things he had learned at the Patala and at Shakpori. He thought of some of the things he had learned about breathing. He thought, too, that this day there would be more to be learned about breathing, and now he decided he would do some breathing exercises. He sat bolt upright, with his spine erect, and he breathed deeply, and he exhaled deeply. He breathed deeply, and he exhaled deeply. He worked hard at it, really hard at it. Of a sudden, he found he was out of his body. He found a most peculiar sensation. The next thing he knew was that he was lying on the ground with the High Lama bending over him. "Boy," said the voice of the Lama, "have you forgotten all that I have told you? Here, remember, the air is thicker than that to which you are accustomed. Do you not know that you are working at this and you've made yourself drunk with too much oxygen?" He sprinkled cold water on the young acolyte's face and shaven head, causing him to shudder with horror. Now he would have to dry himself. "I warned you," said the Lama, "that one should not overdo deep breathing at the start. Even if it does appear to be beneficial, do not overdo it. Certainly you have been doing it in thicker air and really working at it. I saw you from the window. Your lungs were going in and out like bellows. Well, I came just in time or you would have toppled into the gorge, and then I should have had no one with me to make the ponies amused. But come, rise to your feet, and we will return to the lamasery." The Lama reached down and helped the boy arise. Together they walked into the lamasery. The boy felt immensely better at the sight of tea and sampa already prepared. He was even more cheered at the sight of some other things, some sort of fruits, which were strange to him. "Oh," he said to another boy near him, "we do not have anything like those in Lhasa. We have nothing but tea and sampa, nothing more at all." The boy smiled at him and replied, "Oh, we don't do so badly here," smugly. The peasants bring here for our services, you know. We go and toss out a blessing or two, and we get some fruits or some vegetables. It eases the eternal Sampa. Personally, I'd rather be here than at Lhasa. Conditions are so much more relaxed. They sat down, cross-legged, on the floor, in front of the small tables, and then, taking their bowls, they put in tea and Sampa. For some time all was silent, except for the voice of the reader, who, from a high position, looking out across the dining hall, read from the sacred works during mealtimes, because it was not considered fit that monks should pay too much attention to their food. "Be careful how you eat those fruits," muttered the boy, to whom the young acolyte had spoken before. "If you eat too many of those, you'll wonder what happened to you inside. It's not the going down which causes the trouble, it's the after effects." "Oh," exclaimed the young acolyte in very considerable dismay. "Oh, indeed, I've had 5 of them already. Come to think of it, I do feel a bit peculiar inside." The boy, who gave him the warning, laughed and reached for another of the fruits himself. At last, all had finished eating, and the reader had finished his lesson. The abbot rose to his feet and said that on this occasion the great honorable Lama from Lhasa, from the Holy of Holies, the Potala, had come especially to lecture on breathing and on health, and after, any who had any problems with health were invited to discuss the matter with the Lama from Lhasa. They all filed out of the place of dining and moved instead into the temple proper, where there was more room. The Lama bade them all to be seated in comfort. The small boys were in the front. The young monks were next, and in the rear were the lamas, all sitting in orderly rows. For some time, the Lama gave basic instructions and then said, "I must emphasize again that it is not at all necessary for you to sit in the lotus position, or to sit in any position which is uncomfortable. You must, at all times, sit in a position which is comfortable, a position wherein your spine is erect, because only then can you derive the maximum benefit. Remember also that by day you sit with your palms upwards so that you may absorb the good influences of the sun throughout the day. But when you do these exercises after sunset, you will have your palms facing downwards, because then you come under the influence of the moon. But now let us repeat that you have to find your pulse. You place your fingers on your left wrist so that you determine your pulse count, so that you may know for how long you can breathe in or breathe out. The average will be 1, 2, 3, 4 in, 1, 2, 3, 4 out. Say this to yourself out loud 6 or 7 times, and then get the actual beat fixed firmly in your mind so that when you are not feeling your pulse, you're still quite able to sense what your pulse beat is. This will take a few days of practice, and after you have practiced it for a few days, you will find that you can tell your pulse count by a vibration within your body. You will not have to feel your pulse anymore. First of all, you must inhale, always, of course, with the mouth closed. You inhale deeply to the count of 4. It is vital that you breathe in absolutely smoothly without any jerks whatever. Beginners tend to draw in breaths to the count of four, and that is harmful. They must breathe in smoothly at the count, the mental count, of four. Then, when you have counted four, you should have a complete lungful of breath. So then, you breathe out to a count of four pulses. Do this for a time, and after several days, you will be able to take in air for more than four pulses. You may be able to do six or eight, but you should never force yourself. Always do it so that it is well within your capabilities. The Lama looked around and studied the small boys, the monks and the lamas all sitting there, all with their palms facing upwards, all breathing in their own particular rhythm. The Lama nodded to his satisfaction and raised his hand for them to cease the exercise. "Now," he said, "we will do the next stage of this, because we do precisely as you have been doing, but now, after inhaling, you will retain your breath. First of all, then, let us inhale for four heartbeats. Then you will retain that breath for two heartbeats. Then you will exhale over another four heartbeats. The purpose of this particular matter, of this particular breathing pattern, is to purify the blood. It also helps increase the good condition of the stomach and the liver. It strengthens the nervous system when carried out properly. Remember, too, that our basic is 4-2-4. That is merely an average. You must not be a slave to these. Your average could easily be 6-3-6 or 5-3-5. It is exactly that which is most suitable and most strain-free for you." He stood watching while the assembly breathed in, retained their breath, and breathed out. He watched them do it 10, 20, 25 times. Then, again nodding his satisfaction, he held up his hand. "Now we will go a step farther. I have seen, particularly among the younger men, examples of poor posture. You men and boys just slouching around. Now that makes for bad health. When you are walking, you should walk to your heartbeat and to your breath. Let us practice it in this way. First, you must stand erect, not bending over forwards nor tottering over backwards. Erect, with your feet together and with your spine straight. First, exhale as much as you can. Squeeze every bit of air out of your lungs. Then start to walk, and at the same instant, take a really deep breath. It doesn't matter if you use your left or right foot, but make sure it is a really deep breath. At the same time, take a slow, rhythmic step. You will walk in time to your heartbeat. You're going to inhale over four heartbeats. During that time, you will take four steps. But then, you have to take four more steps over the four heartbeats which it takes to exhale. Do this for six consecutive sets of four. But remember, with particular care, that your breathing must be absolutely smooth. It must not be done in pattern with your steps. That is, you do not pump breath in for four steps as you walk. You should inhale as smoothly as you can. The High Lama from Lhasa suppressed a secret smile of amusement as he watched boys, monks, and lamas strutting around trying to carry out the breathing exercises. But, satisfied that they were doing it correctly, he said, "Now, let us remember that there are many systems of breathing, and we have to breathe in a manner which will enable us to fulfill a certain task, because breathing is more than stuffing our lungs with air. Correct breathing can refresh us and can actually tone up our organs. The breathing system I've been showing you is known as the complete breathing system. It is a breathing system which purifies the blood. It helps the stomach and the other organs. It also helps to overcome colds." He stopped and looked around at certain sniffers and resumed, "Here in this, the lowland of Tibet, colds are rife, and nothing much seems to have been done about it. By using that correct breathing system, which I've been teaching you, you can overcome colds. Now here's another system in which you will retain your breath for longer than normal. Sit down, please, with your spine erect, but the rest of you relaxed." He stood, waiting, while the men settled themselves again, arranged their robes around them, and sat with their palms facing upwards, and then he resumed. "First of all, you will do your complete breath, that is, that which we have been doing so far. Then you will retain the air as long as you can, without any strain. After that, you will exhale through the open mouth rather vigorously, as if the air is distasteful, as if you're trying to shoot it away from you as violently as you can. So, let us have it again. First, you inhale for 4 heartbeats. You retain the air which you have just inhaled for as long as you can, without suffering discomfort. Next, you expel the air as vigorously as you can through the open mouth. You will find if you do this a few times that your health will definitely improve." The Lama stood watching his pupils, making sure that they were doing it correctly. Then, spotting one elderly man turning a bluish color, he hastened to him and said, "Now, my brother, you've been trying too hard. All these exercises must be done in a natural manner, in an easy manner. There must be no strain. There must be no effort in it. To breathe is natural, and if there is effort or strain, then you are not getting good effects from that breathing. You, my brother, are using the wrong rhythm. You are trying to force yourself to take in more air than elderly lungs can take in. Be careful. Do all this easily, without strain, and you will feel better." So for the morning, the boys, the monks, and the lamas did their breathing exercises. At last, to the delight of the young acolyte, the lessons were ended, and he and the others were free to go out again into the open air, where the noontime sun was now striking down into the valley, lighting up the gloom and, unfortunately, increasing the heat. Insects buzzed vigorously around, and the poor young acolyte jumped and jumped again, as insects, to which he was not accustomed, attacked him in the most vulnerable portions of his anatomy. End of chapter 6.